Sisters and brothers in the Dhamma, Namo Buddhaya, Jai Bhim.
Jai Bhim.
Well, a very warm welcome to those of you not at Padmaloka, to Padmaloka on this very, very beautiful late May morning. It really feels like the beginning of summer today. Everything is growing beautifully. All the leaves are incredible shades of green, flowers are blooming everywhere, and there's real sort of heat, or the beginnings of heat in the air, which is very wonderful. The sky is a wonderful shade of blue, crops in the fields are growing beautifully. Just now I was circumambulating around Dada Rinpoche's stupa, and I noticed these beautiful pink roses that are just outside the shrine room are in full bloom, and they have a most wonderful scent. So we are continue to live in very, very good conditions. We are continuing to live in a kind of paradise, and as I've said before, we are also well aware of, to the extent that we can be, of what it's like for people beyond Padmaloka. We keep receiving emails from you from different parts of the world telling us how you are and encouraging us in our efforts to practice the Dharma and communicate the Dharma, and we're extending the ways in which we communicate the Dharma online. That's developing more and more. And we keep a bit of an eye on the news just to remind ourselves of what's happening. So yes, we are in very good conditions, and we're very, very good conditions actually to practice and reflect upon the Bodhicaryavatara. And that's what we've been exploring for quite a few weeks now. This is the penultimate talk. Next week will be the last talk. And last week we looked at Virya Paramita. We had a good look at the perfection of Virya. We had a good look at the Bodhisattva's energy. It is joyful perseverance, it is strength, and it is mastery, it is confidence. And in the Mahayana Sutras, the human Bodhisattva, as opposed to the descriptions of the archetypal Bodhisattva, but the human Bodhisattva, as it were, is always depicted and described as being highly capable, highly resourceful, heroic and reliable, the best kind of leader, the best kind of leader who loves the people that they're leading, is always described as helpful and energetic and engaged in all sorts of ways with many different kinds of people. That's the evocation in the sutras of the human Bodhisattva. At the same time, it's always made very clear that the Bodhisattva never really leaves the deep calm and peace of profound meditation and wisdom. The Bodhisattva is engaged, yes, certainly, but he's also at the same time, or she, is also withdrawn and absorbed in meditation. It's very important to know this. It's very, very important to understand this. If we don't understand that the Bodhisattva is someone, as well as being energetic and working for the benefit of all, if we don't understand and appreciate that the Bodhisattva ideal includes at the same time being in the depths of calm and renunciation and profound states of meditation, we don't understand the Bodhisattva ideal at all. A Bodhisattva isn't simply active in the way other people are active. Bodhisattva is not simply just running around doing lots of things for others. Even less so is a Bodhisattva. A Bodhisattva is not someone who's sentimental with all sorts of sentimental feelings and angst about the state of the world. That's not a Bodhisattva either. The Bodhisattva's activity is the expression of their deep realization, their deep meditation, their deep wisdom. As Bhante says in one of his very early essays, compassion is the activity of emptiness. Compassion is the activity of emptiness, the realization of emptiness. At the same time, the Bodhisattva's meditation is profoundly involved with others. Profoundly involved with others, not separate from others. Even when the Bodhisattva is on meditation retreat, and we'll see this more clearly in chapter 8 of the Bodhicaryavatara, the chapter Dhyana Paramita, the perfection of meditation. So let's just hear a little bit, the first verse from that section, and talk about it. So Shantideva says, having increased one's energy in this way, as in Virya Paramita, one should stabilize the mind in meditative concentration, because one whose mind is distracted stands between the fangs of the defilements. Another one of his vivid images. Meditative concentration is the Crosby and Skilton translation of samadhi. Samadhi, of course, represents the complete unification of consciousness at ever deepening levels. That's what the Bodhisattva needs to develop. Otherwise, the Bodhisattva stands between the fangs of the kleshas, the defilements. If you have a distracted mind, the kleshas are ready to bite you, to eat you. So we need to remember that samadhi is the freeing of oneself from distraction and from klesha, and becoming completely absorbed in skillful mental states. And Shantideva describes the conditions for the development of samadhi in the next verse. Distraction does not occur if the body and mind are kept in solitude. Therefore, one should renounce the world and disregard distracting thoughts. Distraction does not occur if the body and mind are kept in solitude. Body and mind kept in solitude is a translation of kaya citta viveka. Kaya citta viveka. Viveka meaning solitude, withdrawal, detachment. It's a very, very important term throughout Buddhist tradition. Viveka is the solitude of body and the solitude of mind, the withdrawal of the body and the withdrawal of the mind. And it's absolutely crucial for successful meditation as far as Buddhist tradition is concerned. Kaya viveka involves taking your body away to a solitary place, into retreat. And yes, you will leave all electronic devices behind. There will be no mobile phones. There will be no laptops or Kindles or any kind of device like that. We have to say that these days. You didn't have to say that, of course, in the 8th century in India. It means as well, yes, I think in this period, switching off even the led meditations online. It means even switching off Padmavajra giving a series of talks on the Bodhicaryavatara. Go away alone. Take a full break and have nothing to pull you back and distract you. Because let's face it, even if you've sort of switched on a nice Buddhist meditation instruction, you can always, I'll just check out the news. There's an email that's just come in, etc., etc. Have nothing to pull you back from your development of samadhi. This is, of course, why solitary retreats, why silent meditation retreats are regarded as so important. Sangharakshita Bhante always used to say, and he never, as far as I know, never changed this, that every single order member should do a 1 month solitary retreat every year. I don't think all order members keep that. Some order members do, very definitely, but not all. But so that you can really practice kaya viveka and then citta viveka. Of course, you have some viveka every day at home. When you go and meditate, you do close everything down. You have to, if you're going to silently do the mindfulness of breathing or the metta bhavana. Everything is switched off. You are alone with yourself, even though there might be other people around. So use the time as much as possible to be with yourself fully. People seem to find this more and more difficult nowadays. But it's so important if there's to be any success in meditation. Distractions may well arise to pull you back. Disregard them, says Shantideva. Just have no regard for those distractions. Another translation of this verse has a nice expression. Put away your vain imaginings. Put away your vain imaginings. Because what happens when you start to meditate on your own, all sorts of things arise to pull you back. Disregard them. So how can we then deepen when we go into solitude to whatever degree? The next verses tell us how. The world is not truly renounced because of attachment and the thirst for acquisitions and other rewards. Therefore, to renounce these, anyone with sense would reflect as follows. Realizing that clear vision, perfectly united with tranquility, can destroy the defilements, one should firstly seek tranquility, and one does that by disregarding one's delight in the world. So what Shantideva is talking about here is the development of the perfect unity of shamatha, tranquility, and vipassana, clear vision, clear seeing, sometimes translated as insight. But Bhante said recently he prefers the translation clear vision for vipassana. So shamatha meditation is, of course, the calming and pacifying meditation. And it needs to be really engaged in fully and thoroughly. We do this particularly through the mindfulness of breathing and the metta bhavana. And of course, I'm assuming we have, we're practicing ethics and so on and the other paramitas. But in shamatha meditation, you're calming the mind, you're calming the heart, you're calming everything down, you're integrating it, you're purifying it, you're expanding it. Ideally, you're moving into dhyana, into the different absorptions. And of course, this is citta viveka. This is the mind withdrawing from the hindrances, withdrawing, at least temporarily, from the kleshas, becoming more and more absorbed in higher states of consciousness. Vipassana, clear vision meditation, is on the comes about on the when on the basis of that calm, on that shamatha, you reflect on the Dharma. Meditations like the six element practice, the contemplation of the Nidana chain, meditation on the Lakshanas and so on, are these vipassana type meditations. But it's very important to understand they're only successful to the extent of the development of your shamatha. These must be in perfect harmony and perfect unity. You won't get very far if you don't have good shamatha meditation to absorb and to give you support to really penetrate what you're reflecting upon. Shantideva doesn't, in his text, describe the spiritual practices that to do with the development of shamatha. That's sort of assumed, I think. I think there's a lot in this text which, particularly in Dhyana Paramita, it's not sort of telling us very much about the sort of some of the meditations to do with concentrating the mind that Shantideva would have been doing and recommending. You do get that in other texts. He's obviously very knowledgeable of the classical meditation practices, and all that will be going on. Instead, he's more concerned to provide reflections to free the mind from attachment. He says that actually it's our craving and attachment that wrecks our shamatha meditation, that wrecks the development of citta viveka, the withdrawal of the mind from the kleshas and the hindrances. So he says, these reflections are very interesting. For what person, he's talking about attachment to friends and family, if you like, for what person is it appropriate to be attached to impermanent beings when that person is impermanent, when a loved one may not be seen for thousands of lives, an earlier translation is a bit clearer. What creature of a day should cling to other frail beings when he can never again, through thousands of births, behold his beloved? Not seeing them, one finds no pleasure and cannot remain in meditative concentration. And even when one does not see them, even when one sees them, one is not satisfied. One is tormented by longing, just as before. One does not see things as they really are. One loses the sense of spiritual urgency. One is consumed by grief, hankering after contact with the one who is loved. So it can sometimes happen on retreat. I think this is what Shantideva is describing, how when you're on retreat, you can develop some nostalgia sometimes for old friends and family, maybe even attachment for one's nostalgic attachment for Buddhist friends. There can be a kind of clinging. He's getting you to say, well, reflect on the impermanence, on their impermanence, on your impermanence. If you dwell on all this, you'll be renouncing the everlasting Dharma. You're not seeing things as they are, as they really are, if you know you dwell on these people and don't engage with your meditation practice. You lose the sense of spiritual urgency. The word for, so I'll come back to that word spiritual urgency in a minute. I want to explore that a bit. It's very important, I think, to understand that shamatha meditation, yes, it does mean calm and tranquility, shamatha, but it's easy to misunderstand. We're not talking here about any kind of ordinary worldly relaxation. I think there's a great confusion of thought when it comes to meditation. People very often, you know, there's so much tension in the world, people want to relax. But in a way, the relaxation doesn't go deep enough, because what's causing the tension in the end is attachment and craving. That's what's breaking up our consciousness, attachment, craving, aversion, and so on. Shamatha meditation, calming meditation, means the total absorption in the flow of skillful states. That's what dhyana is. Complete and total absorption in the flow of skillful mental states. Sangharakshita Bhante has defined meditation as the uninterrupted flow of skillful mental states, the uninterrupted stream of skillful mental states, being completely absorbed in that. And to generate that, according to Shantideva, you need spiritual urgency. This is the Crosby and Skilton translation of the very important word found in Pali and Sanskrit, but which we don't reflect on very often. The word is sangvega. Sangvega is a very, very interesting word, very interesting state. Sangvega means shock, agitation, distress, dismay, horror even, but it's regarded as very positive. It's those things that arise when you really see sickness, aging, death, when you really see the world as it is, when it's stripped of all your fantasies about what you think it should be. An early writer on Buddhism and Hinduism, Ananda Kumaraswamy, has a paper, a very interesting paper. When I was researching the word Sangvega, I found this. He has a chapter in one of his books, Sangvega, or aesthetic shock. Aesthetic shock. Kumaraswamy was not just a writer on religious themes, but also on Indian aesthetics. He says it's related also, strangely, to wonder, because that shock at the state of the world causes you to wonder. It develops in you not dejection, but an urgency and a wondering for the beyond. I think it's that sort of state that the Buddha describes in one of the suttas, that when you realize the truth of dukkha, of unsatisfactoriness, you're like a man who's realizing that his turban is on fire. It's that sort of state. You're really going to do something. The word sangvega is found in the Pali Canon in a very wonderful piece from the Atthakavaka, the section of the eights, where the Buddha, before his enlightenment, is describing what motivates his search for the beyond, his search for liberation. I will tell you the cause of my dismay, Samvega. I will tell you the cause of my dismay. Wherefore I trembled, Sangvijitang Maya. So it's the same, Sangvijita is a bit like Samvega. I will tell you the cause of my dismay. Wherefore I trembled. It was when I saw creatures floundering like fish when ponds dry up, when I beheld people in strife with one another, that I felt fear or horror. And until I saw the evil barb that festers in people's hearts. Very, very powerful language from these very ancient Pali texts. This is what Samvega is. It's not just a personal thing. It's seeing the condition of living beings, like fish floundering in a pond drying up. That's when he felt, you know, that terrible dismay and that sense of urgency to live a full life, searching for the truth, searching for liberation. Samvega is a response to everybody, to the desperation of everybody. It's that sense of the world shrinking, and don't we know it? We feel that, don't we? That the world is shrinking, and people compete for resources. That should fill us with Samvega when we contemplate the state of the world. It should fill us with that tremendous trembling with others, and that sense of developing a great longing to really respond to the situation, longing for an entirely different consciousness and world. An entirely different consciousness and world. Shantideva is in this tradition. He comes out of the best Buddhist tradition. The Bodhisattva is in this tradition. What the perfection of meditation is concerned with is purifying our attachment and clinging, our usual relationship with the world and others, to develop a new and radically different way of being with others. But before we get to that new and radical way, let's just stay with Shantideva, because he continues to reflect on renunciation. His next sequence of verses are all about the renunciation of fools, the bala, the spiritually immature, the childish. One should flee far from a fool, because presumably when you're in retreat, you might be longing for, you know, your old friends, your old mates, or something like that. But why do you do that? They're only going to bring you down. They're only going to pull you back. Why? Well, because you're a fool too. You're spiritually immature as well. And he definitely has verses reflecting on his own immaturity. He basically describes what a fool is. Fools are people who react to each other. That's who the spiritually immature and the spiritually childish are. We react to one another. We're touchy. We fall out over trivialities. When I was reading Shantideva's verses on the fool, I thought, well, I can see a lot of that going on in myself and in our own spiritual community, our wider spiritual community. I think it's very, very important, just because we're in a Sangha, just because we're a Buddhist, that we don't assume that we're spiritually mature. We should really recognize our spiritual immaturity, our foolishness. The Buddha says in the Balavagga, in the Dhammapada, the section on the spiritually immature, the fool, he said, if you begin to recognize your foolishness, your immaturity, to that extent you are mature. But someone who thinks they're spiritually mature, who thinks they're wise and not foolish, they are deemed very spiritually immature very foolish indeed. So I think it's very, very important to really acknowledge our foolishness and to make sure that we get away from situations which is just perpetuating our immaturity and foolishness. Shantideva, of course, is not talking about genuine spiritual friends, genuine Kalyana Mitras, genuine Dharma friends, real Dharma friends. He understands very well that we benefit from contact with such people. We learn so much from such people. His real concern is to generate this sense of viveka, of solitude, to stay in solitude and to go deeper into solitude. So he continues with his reflections on renunciation. And yes, he does reflect on his own foolishness, his concern for worldly gain, his concern for fame, presumably to be a famous Buddhist monk, his concern for more alms food, his concern for honour. But he also remarks that, well, if he gets into that, he'll be resented. People won't like him for that. And it's true, it happens in communities. It really does in spiritual communities. You get all that stuff going on. And he evokes the joys of solitude, of how wonderful it is to dwell with trees. How wonderful the trees are. They're not going to bear any grudges towards you. They're not going to react to you. They're really good companions. I've just started this amazing book called Overstory, by the way, by Richard Powers. I would really strongly recommend it. Just in a few pages, the way he evokes trees and the wisdom of trees is quite extraordinary. And you can see why people would regard trees as companions. So he uses the classic phrase, Shantideva, staying at an empty shrine, staying in a cave at the root of a tree, free from concern, without looking back. Without looking back. When you go into meditation, whether you're on solitary or just in your own home, don't look back once you've started. Just keep going deeper into the solitude. With just a clay begging bowl and a robe that thieves would not use. The robes of the tradition, the really proper robes of the real Buddhist monks are rags stitched together from the charnel ground, because nobody's going to nick those. So for Shantideva and the Buddhist tradition, meditation arises, samadhi, dhyana arises in such radical simplicity as this. Everything is stripped back to what is essential. He even speaks of dwelling in charnel grounds, and of course, charnel grounds, cremation grounds in India were very lonely places indeed. Very often they were places right out beyond the village boundary where the dead were just left to rot. And there you would go to meditate. There the meditator would go. And to free their mind from any worldly preoccupation. There's nothing to distract when you're in such solitude, to distract you from recollection of the Buddha and all the other meditations, so that you can develop one-pointed concentration and training in the complete purification of all the kleshas, of all the defilements. He stayed, before we get to the sort of heart of the meditation he's particularly concerned to teach, there are still more verses to go on which are to do with renunciation and to do with purifying the kleshas. There are many verses on what's called a shubha bhavana, the development of loathsomeness or impurity, the meditation on the unlovely and the unbeautiful, on the loathsomeness. Eventually he talks about meditates on the loathsomeness of his own body, but he's particularly concerned to meditate on the loathsomeness of the body of a woman who he is craving and longing for. Maybe this is something very personal to him, and it's a savage laying bare of the body of this body regarded as beautiful, this person regarded as very beautiful, that you long for, but he does savage contemplations. I can't even repeat them here because they're very, very strong indeed. There's a very poignant verse where he talks about you longed for that moment when you were lifting up her veil. Presumably it's after marriage or something like that. And so you have this very poignant half verse about the lifting of a veil to see this beautiful face. It's of course very much the Indian cultural situation. But he said, well, what it's going to be like, how are you going to feel when you see the vultures ripping off her skin, the veil in front of on her skull? Eek. Some people find these verses very controversial and harsh. I think it's very important to remember here Sangharakshita's very important distinction between doctrine and method. Doctrine and method. Ashubha is not a description of ultimate reality. Things are not ultimately ugly and unbeautiful. The Ashubha Bhavna is a method to cure someone of extreme craving and attachment. Beings are not ultimately loathsome or ugly. Well, they can't be, because you'll see the way Shantideva talks about beings later. Interestingly enough, in our own order, Sangharakshita has never encouraged, as far as I know, and I've read quite widely in Bhante's work, he's never encouraged meditation of this kind on the Ashubha Bhavana. And I suspect because he would think that it probably would lead to people just feeling depressed and even having a sort of negative view of human beings. He has actually said what we should meditate on is Shubha, is beauty. Ultimate beauty. He describes the meditation on the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas as Shubha Bhavana, as meditation on the ultimate beauty of enlightenment. And he said, that will actually lead you to renouncing attachment to lesser beauty. You will just let that go the more absorbed you become in higher beauty. That's a whole sort of subject in itself. But Shantideva's concerns in these verses is to purify the mind of all clinging, all attachment. It's about really purifying the mind of an attitude of using others for our own ends. That's what attachment and craving and the usual kind of erotic love and romantic love in the end is all about. It's all about us. It's all about us getting something. He enters the solitude of body and mind in order to establish an entirely new attitude, a new heart, a new consciousness, a new mind in relation to others, to see them with the bodhicitta, with the heart of wisdom and compassion. So it's important to recognize this. It's so easy for the bodhisattva path to become another sort of version of our attachment and clinging to others, and of our sentimentality, another version of our own exercise of the power mode. The bodhicitta, the arising of the bodhicitta, and the meditation on the bodhicitta that Shantideva does, represents a new and purified relationship with others. So let's look at last at Shantideva's meditation to bring about the development of the bodhicitta. By developing the virtues of solitude in such forms as these, distracted thoughts being calmed, one should now develop the bodhicitta. At first, one should meditate intently on the sameness of oneself and others, reflecting like this: all have the same suffering and happiness as I, so I should protect others as I protect myself. Or if you prefer, all have the same sorrows and joys as I, and I must guard them like myself. Very simple meditation, very simple reflection. It's the celebrated meditation to realize fully and completely what's called in Sanskrit the Paratma Samata, the sameness of self and other, the equality of self and other, or the sameness of self and others, the equality of self and others. It's really a very simple meditation. All beings, us and all beings, are the same in that we all suffer and we all become happy. We all suffer and we're all happy at different times. We share suffering and happiness in common. There is no difference between us in that respect. We all experience suffering, we all experience happiness. No difference between us, between ourselves and any other being. The conclusion that Shantideva draws from this, so I should protect others as I protect myself. As we're the same, I should protect others, guard others, as I guard and protect myself. Very interesting, this language of protection. Doesn't use the word love here at this point. He's using the word protection, caring for, looking after others as I look after myself, being a refuge for others as I'm a refuge for myself, we might even say. We don't have a lot of the sort of oral explanations around this. I mean, you do have commentaries on this, but I think we have to kind of work on this reflection, perhaps ourselves a bit more. Perhaps in the stages of the Metta Bhavana, we can bring in this reflection on the sameness and the equality of ourselves and others. As we go through each stage of the meditation, reflect, there is actually no difference between myself and this other person. I don't need any information about anybody to know that, like me, they experience suffering and happiness. So it's very easy, therefore, in the third stage, where you don't have very much information, all you need to know, and you can be sure, is that they suffer and they're happy, like I suffer and I am happy. So we need to get this clearly into our consciousness, clearly into our concentrated mind, this truth in relation to the people that we're developing loving kindness towards. He goes further, takes the meditation deeper, the reflection deeper, and we have to sort of appreciate that this is happening in an absorbed state. You know, it's not, it can sound very discursive. I don't think Shantideva is in the end just wants us to stay with just thoughts. He wants to bring about a realization. But here's his reflection. Just as the body, which is made up of many parts, like the hands and other limbs, must be protected as a single entity, so too should this entire universe, though it is divided, is actually united in its nature to suffer and be happy. Even though my suffering does not cause distress in the bodies of others, I should, nevertheless, find their suffering intolerable because of the strong affection I have for myself. In the same way that, though I cannot experience another's suffering in myself, his suffering is hard for him to bear because of his strong affection for himself. I must destroy the suffering of others because it is suffering like my own suffering. I must help others too because they are beings just like myself. When happiness is loved by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive only for my own happiness? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not others? So he's trying to get us to see that the universe is a universe of beings. It is one body. The universe is one body. Its beings are the parts of that one body, just in the same way that our body is made up of parts, the hands, the arms, the feet, the legs, the head, and so on. In the same way, the whole universe is one body. Its beings are the different members of that universe, of that one universe. And that means that the whole needs to be protected. Every single being needs protection. So in the meditation he's describing, he's trying to open up a realization, a vision, an insight, an experience, a sense of the universe being a vast body of connected, of interconnected beings, united in happiness and sorrow. Perhaps at this time, where the whole world, and who knows about other parts of the universe, but the whole world is under the same threat of this virus and all of the problems go with it. Perhaps this is a time when we can begin to experience that sense of one world made up of manifold parts, but it's essentially one world. And it gives us perhaps, yes, an opportunity to realize that more fully, the sameness of ourselves and others. In verses 92 and 93 that I would, Shantideva goes a bit deeper. Even though my suffering does not cause distress in the bodies of others, I should nevertheless find their suffering intolerable because of the strong affection I have for myself. Strong affection is the translation of sneha, which is usually regarded as a negative emotion. But Shantideva is just pointing to the fact we all have a strong affection for ourselves. Notice Shantideva is not here interested in the slightest in pseudo-Buddhist ideas of not self. Not interested in that. We all love ourselves profoundly. We might express that in all sorts of weird and wonderful worlds, but we do. We're extraordinarily important to ourselves. Of course we are. Even if we express it in a self-destructive way, we are extraordinarily important to ourselves. We care about ourselves. We love ourselves intensely. And I know that others are distressed when they suffer because they care about themselves, and I know that because I care about myself in the same way. That's the point that he's making. We know that it's hard for people because they care about themselves, and we know that because we care about ourselves. We're no different from other people in that respect. So we're also noticing he's trying to get us to see, look, we care about ourselves. Everybody cares about themselves. In the same way that I care deeply about myself, everybody else does. So I should find their suffering, their sorrow, their pain intolerable, unbearable, because I know what it means to deeply care about myself. That's what he's trying to do in this meditation. As I say, it's not just a reflection. He's trying to get us to really feel it, to sit in metta bhavana and sense fully the care that others have for themselves. And in the meditation, trying to feel that they become as important to us as we are to ourselves. That's what we're trying to do. You know, we can sense our own importance. Well, others are as important to themselves as we are to ourselves. And this leads in verse 94, to this very strong expression, I must destroy the suffering of others because it is suffering like my own suffering. I must help others too because they are beings just like myself. I like that phrase. They are beings just like myself. If you like, perhaps one of the things we need to do in metta bhavana and in our life generally, is to develop a vivid sense, as it were, of the beingfulness of others. We are, our beingfulness is very vivid to us. Our sense of our living beingness is very, very vivid to ourselves. We need to have that sense of the vividness of being in others. It needs to be as strong for others, the sense of beingfulness for others, as it is for ourselves. In one of Bhante's lectures, I think it's one of the Eightfold Path lectures, I think it's in Perfect Speech, where he's talking about loving speech. He says, love is the awareness of the being of another. Love is the awareness of the being of another, the full awareness of the being of another. They are as vivid to you as you are vivid to yourself. In fact, they are even more vivid to you, perhaps even than yourself. Verses 95 to 96 are wonderful. When happiness is loved by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I strive only for my own happiness? When fear and suffering are disliked by me and others equally, what is so special about me that I protect myself and not others? We're not special. Or if you like, everybody is special. Everybody is vishesha, that's the word in Sanskrit. Everybody is distinguished and special. So let's make that so in our consciousness. So we train our minds, we train our heart to realize the sameness of ourselves and others. The aim is to get to a point where we realize that suffering is not owned exclusively by us. Suffering afflicts everybody. So we should change and devote our lives to the alleviation of all suffering, then the deepest suffering, the suffering of conditioned existence itself. And if compassion, the activity of helping others, causes us difficulty, even suffering, Shantideva says, well, that's okay. If you suffer a bit, just a little bit, through helping others, look, more suffering has been alleviated for your little trouble. Your little trouble has actually brought about the reduction of more suffering in the world. So it's well worth it. But Shantideva says, when you really experience this sameness of self and other, your experience of even the most difficult things to help other people is delight. It's just delightful. The alleviation of suffering is delightful. It's a delightful activity if you realize sameness. You see things so differently. You see that the alleviation of the suffering of others is the alleviation of your own suffering. There's just so much joy at the liberation of others, whatever the challenges. And we have these amazing verses. Those who have developed the stream of their mind in this way, realizing the sameness of self and other, those who've developed the stream of their consciousness in this way, their heart in this way, who delight in pacifying the suffering of others, plunge down into the Avicii hell as geese into a cluster of lotus blossoms. Those beings who become oceans of sympathetic joy when living beings are liberated, surely it is they who achieve real fulfillment. For what would be the point of a personal liberation without the sweetness of the liberation of others? In fact, though acting for the good of others, there is neither intoxication nor dismay, nor desire for the resulting reward, just a thirst solely for the well-being of others. Therefore, just as I protect myself to the last against criticism, let me develop in this way an attitude of protectiveness and generosity towards others as well. So these verses, I feel, kind of evoke how different a bodhisattva is. In a number of places, Bhante says it's very, very hard to understand what a bodhisattva really is. They are someone where they see suffering and happiness is no one person's possession, who feels freed and liberated, and so much joy when others are liberated. So the work itself is its own reward. The bodhisattva work is its own reward. It is not about getting a reward. It is itself beneficial. I wonder if this is something to do with an aphorism of Bhante's written years ago. One does not feel compassion for beings because they suffer. One simply feels compassion. So there's no intoxication or dismay when things, intoxication when things go well, dismay when things don't go so well. That's not at issue. It's the work that's important. And there's just a thirst to continually benefit others. And he talks about developing a protectiveness and generosity to others. This reminds me where Bhante is talking about the love, which is the positive counterpart of the first precept. He describes that love and he says this love comes out of the realization of the sameness of self and other. He describes that love as a cherishing, protective and maturing love, which has the same effect on the same spiritual effect on people, on human beings, as the sun on plant life. So try to bring the realization of sameness of self and other into your metta-bhavana, into your life. Feel that sense of care for yourself, that sense of protecting yourself, of wanting the very best for yourself, and the well-being of yourself. Each other person who you meditate upon is exactly the same. They are no different. Shift the center of your gravity towards their well-being, wanting the very, very best for them. Shantideva's convinced that will actually make you happier, more at ease in yourself. Then, having become established in the realization of the sameness of self and other, Shantideva takes Dhyana Paramita deeper into a very mysterious meditation called the Paratma Parivartana, the meditations to bring about the exchange of self and other. Parivartana can mean a magical exchange, almost a sort of shape-shifting. So that might be worth bearing in mind. Let me read some of his reflections upon this. Through habituation, an understanding of an I, sorry, through habituation, there is an understanding of I regarding the drops of sperm and blood of two other people, even though there is in fact no such thing as an I. Why can I not accept another's body as myself in the same way, since the otherness of my own body has been settled and is not hard to accept? I will acknowledge myself as having faults and others as oceans of virtues. I will cease to live as self, and I will take others as myself. So here Shantideva does employ the central Buddhist insight of not self, an Atman. He says that out of habit, out of the constant use of this body and the way our mind works, we've formed a notion of a self, we've built up a notion of self, myself, in relation to the drops of sperm and blood of our parents. Might seem a bit of a strange reflection, but that's what we've done. Our sense of I, of me, of mine, of self has emerged around something that came from others. So then, surely it's easy to now identify myself with someone else's body. That can't be hard. I've done it with this, which was not mine to begin with. So why not now we take charge and identify ourselves with the bodies of others? I think this is quite interesting. If you think that you've realized not self, seen through the self, or whatever way you put it, it might be worth testing it by imagining putting yourself in the place of another, especially somebody you really don't like. How you are with others, how you are for others, always reveals the extent of one's realization of not self. Shantideva goes further. He wants to really surrender this sense of identifying with a self. He says, see yourself as a mountain of faults, others as oceans of virtues. Let go of your self opinion, if you like. Cease living as a self for yourself. Take others as yourself. Work for them. And then he gives the meditation goes a bit further into the exchange of self and others in a similar way to the way he's done it with the realization of the sameness of self and others. In the same way that the hands and other limbs are loved because they form part of the body, why are embodied creatures not likewise loved because they are members of the universe? In the same way that with practice the idea of a self erodes towards this, my own body, though it is without a self, with practice will not the same idea of a self develop towards others too? Through acting like this for the good of others, there is neither intoxication nor dismay. Even after giving myself as food, there arises no expectation of reward. Therefore, in the same way that one desires to protect oneself from affliction, grief, and the like, so an attitude of protectiveness and compassion should be practiced towards the world. That is why the protector Avalokita empowered even his own name to drive away even such fear as the shyness people have in front of an audience. One should not turn away from difficulty because the power of practice, the very thing that once feared to hear, comes something without which one has no delight. Whoever longs to rescue quickly both himself and others should practice the supreme mystery, the exchange of self and other. We love our bodies. We care when different parts of our body are hurt, of course. Now we develop the same sense that all the creatures of the universe form one vast body, every being a limb of that body, and we love it all. And again, in verse 116, there's no intoxication or dismay, even after giving oneself as food. There's no sense of wanting a reward, because you don't regard yourself as giving, really, because there's no separation of self and other. There's no ego, no conceit in bodhisattva activity. Sometimes, you know, we can be working very hard for the Dharma, really working hard for others. And we can have a sense, you know, why am I not getting any reward? Why am I not being acknowledged? That means there's no exchange of self and other. It's still an ego game. We haven't really had that sense of surrendering ourselves to others. There's no sense of giving when you have that transcendence of self and other. You become, it seems, more like the force of the bodhicitta. There's suddenly this strange verse about this is why Avalokiteshvara has given his name to protect people in an assembly. when they're scared to speak. It's a sort of strange verse. But of course, in the Indian context, your reputation is your social security. If you can't give a good account of yourself to others, you're going to be in tremendous difficulty, perhaps, in your life. So we need to become like that force of Avalokiteshvara, like that force of compassion, whose very name can protect people within a situation like that. It's very difficult, I think, to understand what the exchange of self and other really involves. Shantideva describes it, therefore, as the supreme mystery, the Parama Guhya. It's very hard to understand what it really means to put ourself in the place of another and of all others. And Shantideva goes onward. He goes deeper, always wanting to test and challenge this meditation, this realization. We like the idea of imaginatively identifying with others, of all others. It makes us feel very beneficent, but Shantideva describes meditations where we surrender ourselves to others completely, and especially to the most difficult and to the most awkward of people. We renounce a life led only for our own happiness and benefit, and we enter a life, he says, of surrender and service to others. And there is a famous verse, much quoted, much loved, particularly in the Tibetan mind training tradition. All those who suffer in the world do so because of their desire for their own happiness. All those happy in the world are so because of their desire for the happiness of others. Why say more? Observe this distinction between the fool who longs for his own advantage and the sage who acts for the advantage of others. I like the more direct translations from the Tibetan tradition here. All misery in the world comes from wishing for your own happiness. All happiness in the world comes from wishing others' happiness. What need to say many things? Fools do things for themselves. The Muni, the Buddha, acts for the welfare of others. Just look at the difference. Shantideva even puts it like this. For one who fails to exchange his own happiness for the suffering of others, Buddhahood is certainly impossible. How could there even be happiness in cyclic existence? Buddhahood is impossible unless we achieve this exchange. Very, very strong language. That doesn't mean becoming miserable. He means that we're not bothered by hardship, by difficulty, by pain. It means we're not bothered by putting ourselves out in order to work, to liberate others, to bring them the Dharma. We need to renounce all self-concern and live for this greater happiness, this vast happiness. And yes, he does select very difficult people to practice the exchange of self and other with. He selects people to exchange, first of all, someone who feels inferior to him, who resents him. He selects then someone who is a peer, a rival. He selects a superior, someone who looks down on him. We're getting an insight here into the hierarchies of 8th century Indian monasticism. It wasn't all a perfect world by any means. There's all that jostling, all that stuff that goes on. And yes, we can look back, we can think that we're very superior, our sophisticated moderns, but my goodness, you get the same stuff. All politely dressed up, psychologized in our own Triratna community. In the meditation, Shantideva identifies fully with the other. He feels their resentment, or their competitiveness, or their envy, or their haughtiness, vividly. Really feels it, really inhabits their experience, and looks back at himself critically from their point of view. He's going that far in the exchange himself and other. The aim, I think, is to empathize with the hardest of people and to see yourself as they see you. Janet Gatso, a very, very good writer on these themes, says that what Shantideva is concerned to develop is all-round seeing. Seeing ourselves as others see us in order to develop genuine love and compassion for others. Genuine understanding of others, even for them. It's really strong stuff. It's really strong stuff. We know how hard it can be just in the ordinary fourth stage of the metta bhavana. But it must be done. We must test our love, our metta and compassion with the most difficult of people. We must test our powers of empathy and sympathy with the most difficult of people. If we don't, well, our metta will just be, no, it won't be real metta. It will just be about our likes and dislikes. It will just be feelings. It won't be a love that transcends, an emotion that transcends likes and dislikes, springing from profound imaginative identification with others. And this phrase, imaginative identification, is the way Bhante describes Shantideva's reflections on the sameness of self and other and the exchange of self and other. We might not be entirely convinced by Shantideva's reflections. They might not quite do it for us, but we can learn from the poets in the Ten Pillars of Buddhism, where Bhante quotes Shantideva to illustrate how we should practice the first precept. Leave aside the bodhicitta, leave aside the bodhisattva, just our first precept. He invokes Shantideva's meditations. He also quotes Shelley. He quotes the great romantic poet Shelley, the famous passage. The great secret of morals is love, or a going out of our own nature and an identification of ourselves with the beautiful and maybe even the ugly, which exists in thought, action or person, not our own. A man, to be greatly good, must imagine intensely and comprehensively. He must put himself in the place of another and of many others. The pains and pleasures of his species must become his own. Or you might think of John Keats's notion of what powers, if you like, the creative impulse, his negative capability. Negative here meaning the suspension of ourself, the suspension of our ego, if you like, just stopping our self-assertion, letting it go, and our capability, meaning our entering into the life of others, of all others, whatever their nature. This reminds me, talking like this, of that remarkable passage in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, where the Buddha is talking to Ananda not long before his entry into Parinibbana. He's telling him all sorts of secrets, in a way, of the Tathagatas, of himself. And he says to Ananda, Ananda, there are eight assemblies. There are warriors. There are assemblies of Brahmins, of householders, of Shramanas. There are assemblies of different kinds of Devas and Maras. I remember well, Ananda, I have been to hundreds of these assemblies. I've attended these different assemblies, hundreds of them. And before I sat with them, I sat down with them in those assemblies, and before I spoke to them, I adopted their appearance and speech, whatever it might be. I adopted their appearance and speech, whatever it might be. And I instructed, inspired, fired, and delighted them through the communication of the Dharma. And they wondered who it was, who was with them, that taught them in that way. Bhante's done a wonderful lecture on that passage called The Disappearing Buddha. Shantideva has more verses on surrendering to others. And it's clear that for him, the perfection of meditation Dhyana Paramita. Perfecting Dhyana is about the transformation of himself into a being who will live solely for others, a friend to everybody. Let's hear the concluding verses of Shantideva's Dhyana Paramita. Those who are fond of this body are said to be my friends. Why are those who are fond of their own body not also as dear to me as my friends? Therefore, without any regret, I abandon my body for the benefit of the world. For this reason, though it has many faults, I carry it as a tool for that task. Now, enough of worldly affairs. I shall follow the wise, remembering the teaching on vigilant mindfulness and warding off sloth and torpor. Therefore, in order to tear down the obscuring veil, I shall concentrate my mind in meditation, dwelling constantly on the proper object, the bodhicitta, pulling my mind away from false paths. Thank you very much.